I love my morning coffee, but sometimes the crash hits harder than the caffeine. That's when I switch to Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee infused with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics, giving me smooth, focused energy that actually lasts. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Enter for a chance to win $100 cash or even get your entire order refunded. Head to everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
The woman known to history as Josephine Bonaparte was born on the 23rd of June, 1763, as Marie-Joseph Rose Taché de la Pagerie, most likely on the island of Martinique in the Lesser Antilles, a chain of islands at the eastern end of the Caribbean in what was then called the West Indies. Josephine's father, Joseph, was one of the island's sugarcane plantation owners. His father, Gaspard Taché, had come from France to the Caribbean in 1726, settling in Martinique and setting up a plantation there. He also acquired land in the French colony of Saint-Domingue on the island of Hispaniola, where Haiti exists today. The estate there was called La Pagerie, and it was from this that the family had acquired the name de la Pagerie. Though sounding aristocratic, the Tachés were far less affluent than they presented themselves as. Josephine's father had spent some time in his youth in France in the French court, and the family had maintained its connections to the old country. Her mother was Rose Claire de Vergé de Sannois, the daughter of a Martinique plantation owner whose links to the island went back much further than the Tachés, all the way to the mid-17th century. She was of both French and Irish ancestry. Josephine was her and Joseph's first child. They would have two more daughters, Catherine and Marie, born in 1764 and 1766. Josephine was baptized at Les Trois Îlets on Martinique, and it has been assumed she was born there or nearby, although the circumstances of her birth have been debated by many historians, with one theory holding she was actually born on the island of St. Lucia, some 40 kilometers south of Martinique. Regardless of where she was born, there is no doubt that she grew up on Martinique, a French colony since 1635, and one which had, like so many other islands of the Caribbean, developed as a centre of sugarcane production fuelled by the labour of slaves from Africa. Later in life, in order to claim she was younger than she was, Josephine alleged she was born in 1767. Josephine and her sisters were raised on Martinique primarily by an enslaved woman called Marion. Marion and the Taché family members knew Josephine by the name Rose or Marie Rose during her youth there. The name Josephine, which she is known as in the historiography, is actually something of a construct. Many years later, in late 1795, when she met Napoleon Bonaparte for the first time, he decided to call her Josephine based on her middle name Joseph, the female version of her father's name, Joseph. It stuck, and from the mid-1790s she would become known forevermore as Josephine. It was a precarious life for her and the rest of her family on Martinique. Despite being a plantation owner, Joseph Taschier's finances were never flourishing, a product in many ways of the massive expansion of sugar production across the Caribbean in the late 17th and into the 18th centuries, a development which caused the prices which sugarcane plantation owners could charge for their product to fall considerably, even as consumption tripled in Europe over the course of the 18th century. This, combined with Joseph's ill health, ensured that even with a small royal pension for playing a role in the maintenance of the French naval forces in the Caribbean, the family were always on the verge of bankruptcy. He and his wife, though, did have enough money to send Josephine and her sisters to a boarding school run by the island's Benedictines at Fort Royal for several years, where they learned many of the skills expected of high society women of the age, how to read, write, dance, and embroider. Josephine would soon become the instrument through which the Tachés would seek to escape their financially difficult position. Her father's sister, Marie-Euphémie Désir Renaudin, had engaged many years earlier in an affair with François de Beauharnais, a scion of a family of lesser social standing than the Tachés, but of substantial new wealth. The de Beauharnais family soon returned to France, but they left one of their children, a boy called Alexandre, in Martinique, in a curious arrangement whereby he was raised by Françoise's former mistress, Josephine's aunt. At some point in the mid-1770s, when Josephine's sister Catherine was approaching what we would now call her teenage years, and the age at which she might marry by the standards of the 18th century, the Tachés organized for her to marry Alexandre, thus bringing a large dowry to the Tachés from the wealthy de Beauharnais family and saving them from their financial difficulties. However, in the midst of these negotiations, Catherine died. Unperturbed.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
The family immediately proposed that Alexandre should marry Marie, the youngest of the three sisters, but Josephine's mother and aunt felt she was too young, and so Josephine was chosen to marry Alexandre instead. The proposal was accepted, and so in 1779, Josephine and her father set sail for France for the marriage to take place there. Josephine and Alexandre were married in Noisy-le-Grand on the 13th of December 1779, in what are now the suburbs of Paris, but at the time was then a small town to the east of it. Her life on Martinique had provided her with a basic education for a woman of the minor nobility, but by the standards of France itself, she was something of an unsophisticated provincial, deemed harshly by others to be uncultured at a time when French society was changing rapidly. Conversely, she was deemed to be a great beauty as she grew into a young woman, although one major thing which detracted from this was that her teeth, from a very young age, were black and rotten, a product of having grown up on a sugarcane plantation in an age before any form of adequate dental care. Josephine's quiet adaptability was on display early on. She simply learned to smile without showing her teeth. Josephine's life with Alexandre in the 1780s was not easy. Alexandre was an abusive husband who physically attacked her on numerous occasions and was also a serial philanderer with numerous mistresses. They had two children, Eugène, born in the autumn of 1781, and a daughter, Hortense, a year and a half later in the spring of 1783. On one occasion in 1785, she left him, taking the children with her after Alexandre had been both abusive and largely absent for a time, living with his mistress. She moved to Pontamont Abbey, a convent where she sought refuge, but had to leave there eventually after Alexandre showed up and effectively kidnapped young Eugène to force her into returning to their home in Paris. Thereafter, the couple were unofficially separated, though never divorced, at a time when to divorce was uncommon to do. Hortense was sent to Martinique in 1788 to spend several years being raised there by her extended family. Meanwhile, Josephine began to create her own network of lovers back in France, and she became, by all accounts, a skilled lover, something which appears to have been part of the reason why Napoleon Bonaparte became so besotted by her when they first began their relationship several years later. The trajectory of Josephine's life, like that of so many other French men and women and eventually countless people across Europe, was altered drastically by the events of 1789. The 1780s had seen a series of crises in France brought about by harvest failures and mismanagement of the state finances. By the end of the decade, the economic crisis had reached such a height that King Louis XVI and his advisers had no option but to call a meeting of the Estates General, the French Parliament, which had not met in 175 years owing to the absolutist nature of the French monarchy. When it convened at Versailles early in the summer of 1789, the king and his ministers quickly lost control of the situation, and the members of the Estates formed themselves into a national assembly, which effectively became the government of France. The growing French Revolution soon resulted in the storming of the Bastille prison in Paris on the 14th of July, and that autumn, the king and queen were forced by the revolutionaries to relocate to Paris, where they were placed under a form of loose house arrest. In the year that followed, a radical overhaul of French society to remove the privileges of the aristocracy and Roman Catholic Church was undertaken. At this juncture, a constitutional monarchy was kept in place through efforts of many moderates, but the revolutionaries still exercised great power and began building a new kind of society based on the ideas of the French Enlightenment and the scientific revolution. At first, the de Beauharnais family prospered as a result of the revolution. Alexandre had been close to the court of King Louis XVI and was elected as one of the minor nobility to the Estates General when it first met at Versailles in the early summer of 1789, but he quickly betrayed his allegiances to the crown and sided with the Third Estate, elected from amongst the gentry and other figures from the legal and mercantile community, which led the revolution from there on. He even voted for the abolition of feudalism, and in so doing, renounced his own position as a minor noble. He served two brief spells as president of the National Constituent Assembly in the summer of 1791, which had succeeded the National Assembly as the revolutionary parliament. Thereafter, as France ended up at war with Austria, Britain and a number of their allies, he resumed his military career, having served earlier in the American Revolutionary War when France had been allied with the fledgling United States government. Such was the regard he was held in that Alexandre was even offered the post of Minister of War in 1793. Although he and Josephine were largely separated, they were still married and had two children together, and so she benefited throughout the early 1790s from his successful role in the revolution. But it would all come crashing down very quickly in the mid-1790s. Despite his role in the revolution, the course of events from 1792 onwards was to inadvertently lead to Alexandre losing his life. In the midsummer of 1791, King Louis and Queen Marie Antoinette attempted to flee from Paris to the Austrian Netherlands, where they were to find refuge with the government of Austria, where Marie hailed from. They were foiled in their flight attempt and brought back to Paris. With this, many of the revolutionaries began to press for more radical policies, arguing that the king and queen could not be trusted anymore. Eventually, in the course of 1792, King Louis was placed on trial and executed in January 1793, followed by the queen in October 1793. The start of war between France and an alliance of Britain and Austria led to the king and queen being placed on trial in the spring of 1792. It was the beginning of a series of wars involving France, which would last for over two decades. It also led to the radicalization of the French Revolution, and in September 1792, the monarchy was abolished and the first French Republic was established. A year later, a faction led by the Jacobin political clubs and figures like Maximilien Robespierre seized control of political power through the Committee for Public Safety, a body set up to crush counter-revolutionary sentiment and conspiracy. It led to the deaths of tens of thousands of people in less than a year, Alexandre de Beauharnais amongst them, and increased the mass paranoia gripping French political life. Even people who had been front and center in the revolutionary cause came under immense suspicion. The reasons for Alexandre's downfall were twofold. First, his aristocratic background fueled suspicions concerning his loyalties in the fearful days of late 1793 and the first half of 1794. Secondly, he had been in charge during a military reverse for the revolutionary armies at Mainz in western Germany in the summer of 1793. These two things combined led to his arrest on the 2nd of March 1794. Despite their differences over the years, Josephine bravely petitioned the government for the release of the father of her children, but was rewarded only with her own imprisonment in the Carmes prison in Paris, a ghastly place where the walls were stained with blood from the mass murders which had occurred there throughout the early 1790s, and where prisoners were denied the use of toilets and provided with just a bottle of water and mediocre food rations each day. Alexandre was eventually given a perfunctory trial and was executed on charges of conspiring against the revolution by guillotine at the Place de la Concorde, renamed the Place de la Révolution at the time, on the 23rd of July 1794. Josephine would almost certainly have suffered the same fate had the Reign of Terror not come to an end just 4 days later, as Robespierre and his closest associates were arrested on the 27th of July and executed the following day in an event known as the Thermidorian Reaction. Josephine was released from Carmes prison soon afterwards. Historians have speculated that Josephine was possibly suffering from what we now term post-traumatic stress disorder in the aftermath of her imprisonment. Widowed in uncertain times, she attached herself to several prominent men in the year that followed, notably General Lazare Hoche. He was, though, unfortunately married and refused to leave his wife to marry Josephine. Paul Barras, one of the most senior political figures of the Republic in the aftermath of the Reign of Terror, also became her lover for a time, but eventually it was a rising young general by the name of Napoleon Bonaparte whom she ended up in a permanent relationship with. This match was cleverly orchestrated by her and was not just happen chance. Bonaparte, who had already made a name for himself as an artillery officer, who played a pivotal role in the French victory over a British, Neapolitan and Royalist force at the Siege of Toulon in late 1793, became a hero of the Revolution in early October 1795 when he led an armed division of soldiers that prevented a counter-revolutionary seizure of Paris on the 13th of Vendémiaire, the name of the date according to the new French revolutionary calendar. Just weeks later, Joséphine's son, Eugène, visited Napoleon with a request from his mother that the young general, who was still in his mid-twenties and 6 years younger than Joséphine, aid her in reacquiring her deceased first husband's sword as a family heirloom. Shortly afterwards, Joséphine and Napoleon met for the first time in late November 1795. The relationship which followed was a whirlwind courtship. He was almost instantly smitten and began bombarding her with letters declaring his immense love for her. Joséphine, for her part, was not initially in love with Bonaparte. She had been in search of a powerful and well-off husband for a year, and as a rising general and political figure, Napoleon was a good choice, though she remained in contact with General Hoche during this period, and had he agreed to leave his wife, there is a strong possibility that she would have broken off the relationship with Napoleon and married him instead. But this did not happen, and by January 1796, Bonaparte had proposed. Part of the attraction may well have been that by the mid-1790s, despite her rustic upbringing on Martinique, Joséphine was a sophisticated high-society lady with many social and political contacts, whereas Napoleon remained something of a rustic provincial from the island of Corsica. Napoleon, of Italian heritage, was whip-smart, possessed of boundless energy, but ultimately of fairly crude social skills. Joséphine offered sophistication as well as infatuation. They were married in a civil ceremony in the 2nd arrondissement of Paris on the night of the 9th of March, just 3.5 months after their first meeting. Napoleon showed up 2 hours late for the ceremony. Joséphine wore a Republican tricolour sash over her wedding dress, and they both lied about their age on the marriage register in order to pretend that there was just 1 year age gap between them instead of 6. It was a highly appropriate wedding ceremony for what would become one of the most interesting marriages in modern political history. No sooner had Napoleon and Joséphine married than he left France. After 2 years of virtual inactivity in France, he had finally acquired a senior military command, largely on the back of his role in the events of 13 Vendémiaire. He was subsequently appointed to take charge of the Army of Italy, where the French had been fighting the Austrians for control over the north of the country for some time. He left Paris just 2 days after Joséphine married him and would lead the French forces there to a string of major victories which turned the tide of the War of the First Coalition completely in France's favour. His departure for Italy is notorious in accounts of his and Joséphine's relationship, as no sooner had he left Paris than Joséphine began an affair with a middling cavalry officer by the name of Hippolyte Charles. She seems to have been attracted to his sense of humour and the fact that he was more relaxed than her new husband, the affair having the shape of a carefree fling, albeit one that ultimately lasted several years on and off. In time, it would have a major bearing on her relationship with Napoleon when he eventually learned of it 2 years later. In the summer of 1796, Joséphine decided to leave Paris and head for northern Italy to join Napoleon there. Her departure was delayed by several weeks as she claimed that she believed she was pregnant. Whether this was an outright lie or whether she experienced a phantom pregnancy at the time remains unclear. Napoleon's initial campaigning in Italy had seen the northwest of the country secured for the French, as well as the border region into what is now southeastern France, but which was then part of the Kingdom of Sardinia. Incredibly, Josephine's small party of companions who accompanied her to Italy included her lover Hippolyte, whose presence was explained away on account of his being a military officer himself. Napoleon's brother, Joseph, also accompanied them, and Josephine and Hippolyte largely put their affair on hold for the duration of the trip and her time in Italy. She met with Napoleon near Milan and based herself out of northern Italy in the Palazzo Serbelloni in Milan for several months thereafter, as he continued to campaign eastwards towards the city of Mantua, which became the epicenter of the struggle between the French and Austrians in the Italian campaign. During this time, the French were engaged in mass looting of Italy's great paintings, sculptures, and heritage from the Romans and the Renaissance, a great many of which pieces eventually ended up in the Louvre Museum in Paris. Josephine took part in this looting herself and developed an especial penchant for cameos and precious stones purloined from the private collection of the aristocratic Este family and others across northern and central Italy. It was the beginning of her extensive extravagance, as Napoleon afforded her an ever more lavish lifestyle in years to come. Eventually, Napoleon completed his wildly successful Italian campaign, resulting in the Treaty of Campo Formio in 1797, through which France gained control over much of northern and central Italy. These regions, henceforth, would be governed as a number of sister republics which were effectively vassal states of France. Having achieved victory, Napoleon was able to return to France, where he and Josephine lived for a time in an apartment on the Rue Chantarine, which they had rented. Despite the fact it was only a temporary residence, Josephine expended a truly vast sum of money, approximately 300,000 francs, on decorating the apartment with mirrors, sculptures, statues, frescoes, and fresh roses. So over the top was her expenditure on the rented abode that Napoleon eventually decided to buy the apartment, paying out just over 50,000 francs for it, a sixth of the price Josephine had spent decorating it. Such excess did nothing to endear her to the wider Bonaparte family, most members of which were increasingly critical of her behaviour. Several of Napoleon's siblings and his mother had never approved of the union, perceiving that Napoleon had chosen an unsuitable bride in a woman 5 years his senior and with 2 children already from her first marriage. Napoleon brushed aside such criticisms in the early years of their marriage, but over time, he would give more credence to his family's criticism of his wife. Following his victory in the Italian campaign, which had effectively left France at war only with the British, combined with the reputation he had gained earlier at Toulon and in Paris during the events of 13 Vendémiaire, Napoleon was effectively the most revered general of the French Republic, one who could choose his own command. Bonaparte picked a peculiar one. He wanted to lead a massive expedition to Egypt, where he intended to seize the country as a first step in potentially conquering British India and thereby reduce Britain's power in the process. He set sail from Toulon on the 1st of July 1798. It was while he was there that Napoleon at last learned of Josephine's affair with Hippolyte Charles. He was furious, and although he eventually decided against divorce, which was his initial reaction, his relationship with her would never be the same again. Their marriage was one of constant infidelities thereafter. These began for Napoleon shortly after he learned of Josephine's affair, when he began a relationship in Egypt with Paulina Fourier, the wife of a French officer. He made no effort to hide this and actually rode around Cairo with her in his carriage and attended official events in the Egyptian capital along with her. It might well have been the case that Napoleon was making his affair so public in this way in order to allay any criticisms of him that he might have been cuckolded by Josephine. In any event, it was the first of many such affairs, and over the next decade or so, Napoleon would have several mistresses, eventually siring two illegitimate children in 1806 and 1810. The Egyptian campaign was one of Napoleon's least successful, resulting in the temporary conquest of Egypt, but eventually becoming little more than a military disaster. He left the country before France's invasion ended, departing in the early autumn of 1799 on a ship bound for France and leaving his deputy officers in charge. He arrived back in Paris on the 18th of October and proceeded to his and Josephine's apartment. There, an enormous argument ensued as Napoleon confronted his wife for the first time in person after learning of her affair. She assured him that it was finished, a truthful claim as she and Charles had indeed gone their separate ways while Napoleon was away in Egypt. It seems possible until that very day that Napoleon was still considering divorce as an option, but Josephine enlisted her children to appeal to their stepfather, whose affection for Eugène and Hortense was genuine, and eventually, after much weeping and pleading, a reconciliation of sorts was reached. Josephine would never again be unfaithful to Napoleon, though he was repeatedly to her. Her reward for her faithfulness began just 3 weeks later when, in a coup known as the Coup of 18 Brumaire, Napoleon effectively became the head of the French state, establishing a new governmental system known as the consulate, whereby three consuls ruled France. However, there was no doubt that the real power lay with Napoleon as first consul. As such, his wife, Josephine, was now the most eminent woman in France. The next 5 years, while Napoleon was first consul of France, could well be deemed to be the happiest of their relationship. After the initial difficult reunion following his return from Egypt, his thoughts of divorce subsided and the hurt was moved past by Bonaparte. He simply elected to never make mention of her relationship with Hippolyte Charles again, while, at least for the first few years after he returned from Egypt, Josephine decided to turn a blind eye to his infidelities. Indeed, it was during this period that Josephine seems to have developed a genuine affection for her second husband, whereas back in late 1795 and early 1796, during their brief courtship prior to marrying, there is little doubt that she was primarily trying to acquire a wealthy husband whose prospects as a general and political figure were promising. Their personalities gelled well as opposites. Napoleon was always busy and preoccupied with one matter of state or another, whereas Josephine offered some respite from his workaholic nature. They had a shared interest in the opera, with the pair visiting the French theatres hundreds of times. She also became a conduit for others to reason with him or deliver information to him in an unorthodox fashion. For instance, if it was bad news or someone trying to advise Napoleon in a way which he disagreed with, Josephine was enlisted to intercede and reason with him. She was affable and charming, and the foreign minister of France for many years under Napoleon, Charles-Maurice de Talleyrand, was surely overly harsh when he claimed of Josephine's intelligence that no one ever managed so brilliantly without it. On Christmas Eve, December 1800, just over a year after Napoleon became first consul and the de facto ruler of France, both he and Josephine nearly lost their lives. This was owing to a plot to blow up their carriage while travelling through Paris, hatched by a group of counter-revolutionary conspirators and royalists, many of whom had been active in revolts against the republican government in western France throughout the 1790s. They managed to plant an incendiary device in a cart on the Rue Saint-Nicaise, which they believed Napoleon would be travelling along that evening on the way to the opera. He, Josephine, and several others did indeed travel that route to the opera that night in two different carriages with an escort. But owing to a combination of fortunate factors, including a delay Josephine caused as she fussed over her shawl before leaving, and the fact that the driver of Napoleon's carriage was drunk and took a wrong turn, the bomb did not explode as intended. Nevertheless, it killed five other people and injured over two dozen others, including Hortense, Josephine's daughter, whose hand was grazed by some glass as the window of the carriage she and Josephine were travelling in shattered from the explosion. Unperturbed, Napoleon insisted they carry on to the opera, where the First Consul and his family received a standing ovation when the news of the attempted assassination spread. The bravura aside, it was a near escape. Josephine's primary interests, ones which her position as wife of the First Consul and subsequently as Empress of the French provided her with a limitless budget to indulge, lay in gardening and flowers. At various royal residences, but in particular at Malmaison to the west of Paris, she had elaborate gardens laid out and acted as a patroness of some of the foremost gardeners, landscape architects, and horticulturalists of the day. These included individuals from England and Scotland, who she brought to visit France, no easy matter during a period of time when Britain and France were in near constant warfare. Her greatest interest lay in roses, and at the garden at Malmaison she developed one of the most intricate rose gardens ever planted, acquiring dozens of different types, some sent to her by Sir Joseph Banks, the director of the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew. These were cultivated by Josephine in collaboration with André Dupont, one of the great French garden experts of the first half of the 19th century. She even commissioned the botanist and painter Pierre-Joseph Redouté to paint many of the roses at Malmaison, images which were subsequently published posthumously with descriptions as Les Roses in the late 1810s, a work which has a claim to being the first book ever published exclusively on the subject of roses. Her patronage of roses popularized growing them in France and other parts of Europe in the early 19th century, and their position as one of the most prized flowers in modern times perhaps owes a considerable amount to Josephine. Josephine also patronized the arts extensively. In the sphere of painting, she employed Pierre-Paul Proudhon, one of the greatest French Romantic painters and the foremost employer of the chiaroscuro painting style, combining sharp contrasts of light and dark. His allegorical masterpiece, Justice and Divine Vengeance Pursuing Crime, was completed in 1808 under the patronage of the imperial couple. Other artists of the time who were patronized by her were Jacques-Louis David, François Girard, and Antoine Jean Gros. She was pivotal in Gros' emergence as a leading artist of the day after the pair met in Genoa in 1796 when she traveled to northern Italy while Napoleon was campaigning against the Austrians there. Gros was quickly commissioned to paint one of the most famous portraits of Napoleon ever produced, General Bonaparte at the Bridge of Arcole. In terms of sculpture, she was a major patron of the Italian Antonio Canova, who produced several works either of her or of different scenes, notably Dancer with Her Hands on Her Hips and The Three Graces. The four works which she commissioned from him were bequeathed to Tsar Alexander of Russia, who became a close friend of Josephine's in the last months of her life. After her death, these sculptures have ended up in the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. Finally, in an age when interior decoration and the production of furniture had been elevated to an art form, she employed Charles Percier and Pierre Fontaine, two of the most acclaimed interior decorators of the era, to furnish many of the royal palaces and residences used by herself and Napoleon during the 1800s. Numerous portraits of Josephine were painted which are well known today. Arguably, the most famous was that painted by Gros in 1809, not long before her divorce. It is a relatively straightforward portrait of her, which, in an age before even the most basic daguerreotype cameras, is the closest we have to a realistic depiction of her. Here, we see a woman with dark brown hair cut relatively short, a look which became more common in the 19th century and which she served to popularize. Her lips are pursed, doubtlessly a common facial expression for her, given the blackening of her teeth early in life. It mirrors the description of her provided by the esteemed Prussian philosopher Wilhelm von Humboldt after meeting her in 1798, that she had a pretty, delicate look, but the face of a woman of the world, one with a certain amount of experience. More impressionistic was the portrait which Proudhon painted of her in a woodland setting. The entire scene was meant to cast her as Diana, the Roman goddess of the hunt, in imitation of several famous Renaissance and Baroque paintings of Diana. A sketch which Proudhon had prepared as a model for the painting also showed Josephine with a lyre resting next to her, an allegorical statement about her role as a patroness of the arts in France, but for reasons unknown, this was not included in the finished painting. The most famous depiction of Josephine, however, relates to the events of late 1804. In the course of that year, in response to the renewed outbreak of war across Europe and other developments, Napoleon was urged to consolidate his position and have himself crowned as Emperor of France. Though reluctant at first, he eventually relented and on the 2nd of December 1804, he was crowned at Notre Dame Cathedral in the center of Paris as Emperor of the French, in a spectacular and highly managed ceremony presided over by Pope Pius VII in imitation of the coronation of Charlemagne, the great Emperor of the Carolingian Empire, in Rome, back on Christmas Day in the year 800. Josephine was crowned alongside her husband as Empress of the French, though this had required them to undertake a religious marriage ceremony the day beforehand, the Pope being unwilling to carry out the ceremony when he learned their union in 1796 had been a civil ceremony. They married each other again on the 1st of December, and the following day, Josephine was crowned as Empress. It was a long way to have come for the daughter of a sugarcane plantation owner from Martinique. Josephine's role in the ceremony was immortalized 3 years later when Jacques-Louis David, the greatest painter of the Revolutionary and Napoleonic era, completed one of his masterpieces, The Coronation of Napoleon, which the Emperor had commissioned him to produce. The central action of the painting is Josephine in the very center, kneeling at the bottom of some steps, while Napoleon, at the top of the three steps, raises aloft the crown which he was about to place on her head. It is on display today in the Louvre in Paris, a testament to Josephine's centrality to French political life at the start of the 19th century. Josephine was a popular empress over the next 5 years. As Napoleon was to state at one point, "I win battles, but Josephine wins hearts." Some of this was based on her charity. This was not produced in the form of patronage of military hospitals or schools or orphanages, common actions among elites of the day. Instead, she provided extensive financial support to people individually. 500 francs, for instance, were given to a former nurse of King Louis XVI. She was generous in distributing money here and there. On top of this, she was the epitome of fashion, spending lavishly on her wardrobe and maintaining opulent households. During years when people had developed a sort of wistful fondness for the days of the monarchy and the excesses of Versailles after years of revolution and war, Josephine was a kind of throwback to the days of the Bourbon monarchy, and it heightened her popularity amongst the general populace. But her spending couldn't help but exasperate Napoleon. While empress, she was allocated an annual budget of 360,000 francs, a not inconsiderable amount of money. Yet, during the five-year period in question, she spent this money and also ran up additional debts of 3.2 million francs. Her husband, aware of her spendthrift nature, issued an order that any craftsman, tailor, or merchant who was owed money from the empress was to write off 20% of the bill, arguing that anyone who she had run up debts with must have been overcharging. The irony of Josephine's coronation as Empress of the French alongside Napoleon in 1804 was that their marriage was becoming more strained. An episode at the Chateau de Saint-Cloud, a former royal residence in the western suburbs of Paris, which Napoleon and Josephine had requisitioned as one of their favourite houses, epitomises the issues. On the 25th of October, just 5 weeks before the coronation, Josephine was entertaining guests at the salon at the chateau when she spied one of her ladies-in-waiting, Elisabeth de Vaudet, through a window hurrying from her apartment. Josephine had been suspicious of her and Napoleon's activities since de Vaudet had accompanied her husband to Aix-la-Chapelle in the late summer, where Napoleon had aimed to improve his fertility by using the famed thermal baths there, with the goal of him and Josephine finally having a male heir to succeed his throne. Investigating further on that late October day, Josephine found Napoleon and de Vaudet in a small apartment together, not far from their own rooms. An intense argument followed, with Josephine attacking him for his constant unfaithfulness, and Napoleon then stating he would divorce her if she continued to spy on him and monitor his behaviour. The tension was only eased through the intercession of Josephine's daughter, Hortense. Once again, Napoleon's affection for his stepchildren won out, but the cracks in the marriage were clear. There is no doubt that Napoleon and Josephine were deeply fond of each other, despite their mutual betrayals of one another over the years, but by the time of the explosive row at Saint-Cloud in the late autumn of 1804, there was a major issue which was driving a wedge between them. This was the simple fact that their marriage had not resulted in children after nearly 10 years together. This was extremely problematic for Napoleon, who, like many a monarch or emperor before him, King Henry VIII of England being a classic example, was preoccupied with the need to sire a legitimate male heir to succeed him one day and continue his line. By 1804, his family members, many of whom had always disliked Josephine, were urging him to divorce her and marry again to have children, noting that she was now into her early 40s and her childbearing years were coming to an end. But Napoleon was reluctant for two reasons. Firstly, while love may be too strong a word, he certainly admired Josephine and wanted her to remain as his wife. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, he clearly believed during these years that the lack of children in the marriage was because he himself was sterile. A logical conclusion, given that he had not had any children himself through any of his affairs or otherwise, whereas Josephine had two children from her first marriage. This would change in late 1806 when one of Napoleon's mistresses, Caterina Eleonora de la Plaigne, his liaison, which the emperor's sister Caroline had orchestrated, gave birth to a son whom they named Charles. Charles was illegitimate and did not provide the heir Napoleon wanted, but his birth proved that Napoleon was not sterile and could have children if he remarried. From that juncture onwards, his marriage to Josephine was on borrowed time. No matter how precarious Josephine and Napoleon's marital situation became, it never impacted negatively on the lives of Josephine's two children from her first marriage. Napoleon had taken well to being a stepfather and was conscientious in the role, furthering Eugène and Hortense's affairs in the 1800s. Eugène had served with Napoleon as an aide-de-camp in Italy in 1797 and accompanied him to Egypt the following year. Thereafter, during the first consulate, he had been promoted to senior military positions, and in 1804 he was made a prince of the realm. 6 months after Napoleon and Josephine were crowned as emperor and empress, Eugène was made viceroy of the Kingdom of Italy, Napoleon's royal representative there. Over the next several years, he was often in charge of the army of Italy during the Napoleonic Wars, and although as Napoleon's stepson he was excluded from succeeding as emperor, Napoleon did make him the heir to the Kingdom of Italy. On a somewhat different note, Hortense had married one of Napoleon's younger brothers, Louis, in 1802. In 1806, her stepfather ended the Batavian Republic, which had been formed as the government of the Netherlands back in 1795, and transformed it into the Kingdom of Holland, with Louis and Hortense as king and queen thereof. As such, Napoleon promoted his stepson and stepdaughter as though he were their biological father. While Napoleon and Josephine's marriage was in tumult in the years following their coronation as emperor and empress, ultimately, Napoleon divorced Josephine in order to remarry a suitable bride that would also bring advantages from a political perspective. This occurred at the end of the 1800s as a result of the way the Napoleonic Wars developed. By the time the coronation occurred in December 1804, the continent was already entering the War of the Third Coalition, in which France would face a new coalition led by Britain, Austria, and Russia. With victory at the Battle of Austerlitz in December 1805, Napoleon utterly defeated Austria before the outbreak of the War of the Fourth Coalition occurred with Prussia's declaration of war on France. Bonaparte again inflicted a crushing defeat on the Prussians, and with the signing of the Treaties of Tilsit in the summer of 1807, French rule over most of Europe, as far east as Poland, was established. But despite this, the Austrians decided to make war again on France in 1809 in the brief-lived War of the Fifth Coalition. After another defeat and the capture of Vienna, the Austrians were forced to cede further territories and were utterly defeated. At this juncture, the Austrians, fearing that they would be turned into a second-rate power as the Prussians had been through the Treaty of Tilsit, decided that an alliance with France might be the best course after being defeated in war after war by Napoleon since the 1790s. It was in this context that a possible marriage alliance between Napoleon and the Austrian Habsburgs, with a marriage between the Emperor of the French and Marie-Louise, the daughter of Emperor Francis II of Austria, was proposed. It was on the 30th of November 1809 that Napoleon informed Josephine of his desire for a divorce, noting calmly that his decision was purely a practical one born out of his need to have an heir for the realm and to fulfill his desire to have legitimate children. Josephine's reaction was not what he had hoped for. Hours of anguished screaming followed. At dinner that evening, she apparently fainted. For days, there were screams heard from her apartments and statements about her inability to live If they divorced, perhaps a threat of some sort that she would try to take her own life if he insisted on this course of action. Things only calmed down from the 5th of December onwards, after her son, Eugène, arrived and made it clear that even his or Hortense's intervention would prove ineffective on this occasion, despite it having led to a reconciliation when Napoleon had returned from Egypt in 1799 and in October 1804 when Josephine had discovered him with his mistress, de Vaudet. Accepting reality, Josephine agreed to go along with the divorce, which was finalized a few weeks later on the absurd grounds that their marriage back in March 1796 had been insufficiently attended and there were not enough witnesses to it. Their second marriage in December 1804 was ignored. The negotiations with Austria accelerated thereafter, and on the 11th of March 1810, Napoleon married Marie-Louise by proxy, with the formal marriage taking place in the Louvre a month later. The heir, which Napoleon had long wished for, arrived less than a year later, when Napoleon François Joseph Charles Bonaparte was born on the 20th of March 1811. Josephine was hardly left destitute following the divorce. Although she had to move herself, her staff, and her belongings out of the residence at Saint-Cloud and the Tuileries Palace in central Paris, she was provided with more than suitable alternatives. The Élysée Palace, which today is the official residence of the presidents of France, but which had passed through various aristocratic hands in the centuries since it was built, by the time it was granted to Josephine, was allotted to her, though she primarily resided after her divorce at the Château de Malmaison, a château west of central Paris towards Saint-Germain-en-Laye, a property which Josephine had purchased back in 1799 while Napoleon was absent in Egypt on credit with the money she expected him to bring back from North Africa. It was a run-down residence at the time, but located on 150 acres of land, and Josephine transformed it through her love of gardening, establishing not just gardens, but extensive orchards and greenhouses, as well as a quasi-zoo of animals from as far away as Australia. It was here where she lived out most of the remainder of her life, with some time spent at the Chateau Navarre in Normandy, which she had also been granted as part of the divorce, along with a healthy annual pension to cover her lavish expenses. In April, the government also bestowed the title of Duchess of Navarre after the chateau in Normandy. Napoleon continued to visit her on occasion, even after he remarried, but these visits grew less frequent over time and became virtually non-existent from 1812 onwards, as the wars he was engaged in perpetually finally turned against the emperor. While Josephine lived her life in imperial retirement at Malmaison, events were changing rapidly across Europe, and for once they were working against her former husband. In 1812, irked by Tsar Alexander of Russia's unwillingness to enforce the continental system, a massive economic embargo of British goods and trade which France had tried to impose across Europe, Napoleon decided to invade Russia with an enormous army of nearly 500,000 men. He initially succeeded in conquering much of the west of the country and even seized Moscow, but the Russians never surrendered and burnt Moscow as they retreated. By the early winter, Napoleon was forced to retreat back towards Poland. But his army was devastated in the process by an exceptionally cold winter and constant guerrilla attacks as they made their way westwards. In the aftermath of the disastrous invasion, a new alliance of the European powers was formed and the War of the Sixth Coalition broke out. Even Austria eventually declared war on the French, ignoring the marriage alliance which had led to Josephine's divorce. The Battle of Leipzig in mid-October 1813 was the defining military clash of the war that followed. The French lost the engagement, and in the months that followed, the Prussians, Russian and Austrians moved westwards towards France. Despite concerted efforts to block their advance by early April 1814, they had closed on Paris, and Napoleon was forced to abdicate. He was subsequently allowed to become Emperor of the island of Elba off the coast of western Italy, but the British, who were opposed to the arrangement, correctly feared that it would not be long before he tried to return to France and reclaim power from King Louis XVIII, a member of the Bourbon royal family which had quickly been re-established as monarch of the country. Josephine had been at the Chateau Noir for much of the early part of 1814, but returned to Malmaison in early April, right around the time Napoleon abdicated for the first time. There, she struck up an unlikely friendship with Tsar Alexander of Russia, who had led his armies all the way across Europe and who called to visit the Emperor's former wife. She was also fortunate to be reunited with her children after the family being split up for so long. For years, Eugène had primarily been occupied in Italy, while Hortense also visited Paris around this time, having been living in the Swiss Confederacy for several years, where she had been engaged in a lengthy affair with Charles Joseph, Comte de Flahaut. Josephine consequently had her family around her during what would be the last stages of her life, while, as a result of Tsar Alexander's protection, Eugène and Hortense were not punished in any fashion for their ties to Napoleon. However, her health was declining as she had developed flu-like symptoms in the last days of April and first days of May, and in the weeks that followed, she could not shake off what is now understood to have been pneumonia. She continued to socialize regularly with the Tsar, and is believed to have also requested around this time that she should be allowed to leave France and join Napoleon on Elba. Josephine never made it to the Italian island, if she had in fact requested to be allowed to do so. Instead, her condition deteriorated dramatically towards late May, running such a severe fever that when Alexander came to dine with the family on the 27th of May, she could not get out of bed to receive him. Alexander sent his personal physicians to attend to her at this juncture, who reported back that her state of health was very grave. Her condition worsened further the following day, so much so that on the morning of the 29th of May, Whit Sunday that year, the last sacrament was given to her. She died around noon with Hortense and Eugène present. In recognition of her long spell as Empress of the French, her body was sent to Paris and lay in state for 3 days for the public to pay their respects. She was subsequently buried at the Church of Saint-Pierre-Saint-Paul in Reuil, to the west of Paris, not far from Malmaison. She was 50 years of age at the time of her death. Napoleon took the news of Josephine's death badly, retiring to his room for 2 days and scarcely being seen, an unusual thing for a man of typically endless energy to do. He did not remain on the island for long. In late February 1815, he escaped and made landfall in southern France, arriving to Paris in mid-March, where he quickly reclaimed power. But it was a fleeting second coming. Britain, Prussia, Austria, Russia, and their allies all began mobilizing their armies again to crush Bonaparte before he had a chance to resurrect his empire. At the Battle of Waterloo, in what is now Belgium, on the 18th of June, Bonaparte was defeated by the British and Prussians. Just days later, he was forced to abdicate for the second time. On this occasion, the British were determined he would never be able to return to plague them, and he was dispatched as a prisoner to the island of St. Helena, a British colony in the middle of the South Atlantic and one of the most isolated places on Earth. He lived out the remainder of his life there until he died on the 5th of May, 1821. With his last words, he is alleged to have said, "France, the army, head of the army, Josephine. Josephine's descendants would go on to rule in many countries. Hortense's son with Louis Bonaparte and Josephine's grandson, Charles-Louis Napoleon, became president of France in 1848 and then Emperor Napoleon III in 1852, ruling the Second French Empire for nearly two decades. Eugène had a daughter named Josephine after her grandmother, who married King Oscar I of Sweden in 1823. Through her, the royal houses of Sweden, Belgium, Denmark, and Norway, and the Grand Duke of Luxembourg are all partially descended from Josephine. Josephine Bonaparte has fascinated people for the last two centuries. We might well ask why. After all, she achieved little herself, her prominence within French society being owed almost entirely to her relationship with Napoleon and his dogged pursuit of power. Even as the wife of the first consul and then as Empress of the French, her interests primarily lay in decorating her homes and developing elaborate gardens. She displayed little of the charitable sense which often engenders considerable admiration in modern royalty through the patronage of orphanages, schools, and hospitals. And yet, she has been the subject of many books, not least by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, mastermind of Sherlock Holmes, and been depicted at length on screen. The only explanation for this is that her character was enigmatic enough and her relationship with Napoleon sufficiently interesting to have made her of interest to people generation after generation. Napoleon was beguiled by her, at least initially, and ignored many social conventions in order to marry her. Even after he learned of her infidelity, he remained with her and made her Empress of the French in 1804, while his final thoughts on his deathbed in St. Helena were apparently of her. There was, perhaps, good reason for this. For all that she might have appeared superficial in her pursuits and character, there seems to have been a keen intellect underlying her personality. She was, in short, something of an enigma. Perhaps that is why she has proved to be of such enduring interest to so many people. What do you think of Josephine Bonaparte? Do you think she and Napoleon really loved each other despite their affairs and the unorthodox nature of their relationship? Please let us know in the comment section. In the meantime, thank you very much for watching.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Graham laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Graham keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Graham laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.